And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where I am thrilled, and I always say I'm thrilled a lot, but I'm actually legitimately, I'm not lying at all, thrilled to be joined by basketball fan, stand-up comedian, fresh off a wildly successful special called The Great Depression, which everybody should have watched already or should watch now. Gary Goldman, how are you?
I'm so good. I'm great, and also The Great Depression has a basketball ending. I shoot baskets at the end.
We're going to talk about that.
Yes.
I would have you on anyway, or try to,
because
I like having awesome people on.
Thanks.
But anytime when I watched it, and then there was clearly like a basketball theme running through it,
right.
I turned to my wife who was watching with me. I was like, I'm going to try and get this guy on.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because I got an excuse. I got an
end. Oh, yeah, of course. Yes.
So.
But I was a fan before I think you knew of me, probably.
No, I knew of you.
Okay.
I knew of
All right,
you.
That's good.
But
All
this
right.
special, I think, well, let's just start with that. Have you already, so it's run on HBO, it's on demand, but it's on demand.
I think sometimes it airs in regular times, but I don't know anybody who watches HBO during regular times. Like it's for me, it's an app, really. Yeah.
Have you already gotten the sense that this is a life-changing moment for you?
Yes. Yeah. Career-changing, life-changing, and it's more than I expected. I knew there was the potential to help a lot of people just from the live shows that I was doing, that people would come up to me and give me really, really positive feedback and also feel comfortable opening up to me about their struggles, which is so interesting, because I held off on telling anybody about this for years because I didn't think anybody else would really, or very few people would relate. And then you find out, oh no, everybody is connected to this depression, anxiety, treatment story in some way. They're either themselves or through a family member or a friend. And just the opportunities that I've gotten because of this, I'm running around today meeting with book publishers about writing a book, not about The Great Depression, but about this other idea I have, which the sensibility of The Great Depression is going to be in the book, which is that I can talk about my life in a funny way. So it's more of a memoir about some of the components of The Great Depression, in that I have this weird memory of my life since I was 4 or 5 years old. I can remember all these events. So I don't know if you have a friend who remembers everything for you, but I'm that friend.
That
whenever
you.
Anybody says, who did we have in third grade and who was the girl who stuck her finger in the pencil sharpener and she bled and they had to call the EMTs, and I know the name and the grade and who the teacher was, and it's not a curse, because it's not usually for trauma as much as it is for trivia. So that's really good. I've been able to get past certain traumatic things in my youth, but the trivia of my youth and also with sports. I mean, that's a weird thing, is my memory for sports and athletes and statistics and things from 5 to till college. I mean, incredible. And then now I only remember championships. I knew every Final Four team from like 1970, and then in around 1999, I stopped memorizing the.
I think that's called adulthood.
Yes.
I've had a similar
really?
Experience where, like,
yeah.
I used to be, and I'm always envious, like Bill Simmons, my friend and former boss.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah, he'll just be,
oh
like,
my word.
One of the, my flashbulb memories of like, this is how good Bill is. It's like, we go to All-Star, and he just sets up a room for podcast guests, because all the players are kind of torn around this hotel.
Right.
And most of them are booked in advance. But sometimes he'll just see somebody and be like, hey, you got 15 minutes? Like, let's come on in. And he got Bill Fitch to come in, the coach
wow.
of the Celtics,
oh, yeah,
coach
yeah.
of the Nets, Clippers,
NBA
on and
champion,
on.
80-81.
Yeah. Yes.
Amazing coach. And also coached a very weak Cleveland team to the playoffs.
That's right.
Yes.
And so Bill Fitch comes in. No preparation. We didn't even know Bill Fitch was there.
Wow.
And he sits down and Simmons is like, so I remember 1980 draft. You guys had the 17th. I'm just making this up. You guys
right,
had
right,
the 17th
right, right.
pick.
Yeah.
And so-and-so was available. Yeah. And you wanted so-and-so. And this guy. And I know it's Celtics, so everyone thinks Bill, of course, he remembers himself.
No.
But it's like, I don't remember. Like, his
no.
memory for that
no.
kind of stuff
it's,
is unbelievable.
It's incredible. But that's where I discovered you on the original BS report.
The BS report.
Yeah.
So basketball run. So for people who have not seen this, first of all, it's hilarious. Go watch it. And it essentially is an hour and 15-minute stand-up set
yes.
about a severe depression and anxiety for which you went to the hospital.
Yeah.
You underwent all sorts of therapies and you've come out the other side.
Yeah.
Feeling much better about life. But and it's not depression. Like, I'm kind of in a bad mood now. And then this is serious.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you
yeah.
couldn't go.
Yeah.
You thought about
virtually catatonic. Yeah.
You thought about retiring, which yes. is a great bit about yes. how retiring yes. is a little pretentious for what yeah. you were.
Right.
And it's moving and it's funny. Basketball is a theme that runs through it. You are 6'6".
Yes.
Played basketball essentially your whole life.
Yeah.
And you have a bit in the movie, you said basketball is really the sport for depressives.
Yes.
Because you can practice it alone.
Yes.
That's not a joke though, right? Like, I really think that's part of the appeal of basketball.
Yeah, I think it's so important because it is meditative and it's also like practicing an instrument to a certain extent. I think that's why people compare basketball to jazz a lot, because there's so much improvisation in basketball, and there are infinite ways you can pass a football, but it seems like there are even more ways to pass a basketball and also to dribble. It's such a beautiful game, but I was initially drawn to it for two things. One, I didn't like the more contact heavy sports when I was young. I was pretty passive kid.
I never played football myself.
Yeah.
I didn't have any interest in getting harmed.
Yes.
Like having other people whose goal was to harm me was not interesting
right.
to me.
Well, I remember when I was 6 or 7, there was a player for the New England Patriots named Daryl Stingley who was paralyzed by an opposing fellow by the name of Jack Tatum. And I remember thinking, oh, and they're going to keep playing football after this half. I can't believe that. And so I really didn't want that to happen to me. And so when I found out basketball had rules that if you really hit somebody, then you would get free shots, and that they could eventually be thrown out of the game for hitting too many people. I was drawn to it. And then when I found out that, oh, you can practice by yourself, you can go to the park with the ball, and if nobody's there, you can just shoot around, and it's exhilarating. And then you find everything is a hoop. So I'm shooting at walls, I'm shooting at the roof of the house, and just dribbling around. And then I was able to go to basketball camps as a kid. Mike Jarvis, who is the Patrick Ewing's high school coach, had while Ewing was in high school, he had a camp that I went to, and I don't think it's for everyone, but sports camps are a great way to solve racism, because a lot of the kids that I went to school with had never met a black person, and then you go to basketball camp and you're around people that you don't have in your everyday life, and you realize, oh, they're just like me, and I think it goes a long way, and sports in general goes a long way in solving a lot of problems.
This is why whenever, you know, debates about affirmative action and stuff like that comes up, people are like, oh, that's just diversity for diversity's sake, and my response is, diversity for diversity's sake is like unbelievably
yes.
valuable.
That's enrichment for enrichment's sake.
That's the whole thing, is just like meet other people who are not like you, and it changes the way you perceive the whole world. Like,
it's education.
If that's the only thing it's for, then that's tremendously valuable. That's more valuable than a Shakespeare class at Harvard or something.
Such a great point. That's all it does is diversify. I mean, that's all it has to.
So what was your ritual as a kid? Was there a park you went to? Did you only want to shoot by yourself? Like, if people were on the court, we'd be like, oh man, I gotta wait for these people to get off.
Well, I would say shortly after I got into basketball, my brother put up a hoop on a pole in front of our house. My mom worked at Sears, so she got a discount on a hoop, and we bought it was just a regular pole, and he was really good with his hands. And then some neighborhood kid or a vandal ripped the hoop off the backboard, and my brother designed this thing so that I could take the hoop off the backboard at night.
Ah.
And using a garden rake, one of those steel garden rakes, I could remove the hoop and put it in the garage at night and then put it back the next day. And so the only thing was that it was a little bit rattly, so if you didn't swish it, it would probably bounce out. But that was good.
That's good
practice. That's good for shooting. And so I practiced a lot at that. And then when I got good enough, I started going to this park near my house, and I would ride my bike, and it was about a 2-mile bike ride, and I would go play there. And there were some really good players there that I wound up playing with and through high school. So that was really something. I was very lucky to have good parks near my house, and my whole thing was that I would wear through basketball so quickly because I was dribbling all the time. There were so many great stories about guys like Larry Bird and Pistol Pete Maravich being obsessed with their basketball that you didn't feel like a freak by practicing all the time. There couldn't have been a better time in Boston sports history to be into basketball than when Larry Bird.
Yeah, you're
was
a
there.
Kid in the 80s. Yeah. I'm 42, so
yeah,
I was
I'm 49.
Yeah, so you were of the perfect age.
Perfect age.
So I was
like
a little too young to appreciate.
Yeah.
I mean, I appreciated it, but I was like, so I was born in 77, so I was nine, or about to turn nine, and when okay. the 86 team won.
Right.
So the 81 team, for instance, I have
yes.
no memory of that
yes.
at all.
Yes. Oh my gosh, that team was incredible. The 81 team was incredible. So good. McHale is a rookie.
Who was your favorite of the 80 Celtics?
I think that I didn't want to like the same guy that everybody else liked, so I really liked Gerald Henderson.
Interesting. Well,
yeah.
The famous steal.
That's a bigger steal than Havlicek, really. I've always
yeah,
wanted
they don't
to
win
have
that,
this,
without that
this
win.
Debate because Havlicek sealed the game, and it was very exciting. But they don't win that game against the Lakers in 84, and they don't win that game in 84. I don't know that they win that series.
I don't think Simmons will kill me for saying this. They shouldn't have won that series. The Lakers were better in 84, I think.
Certainly.
And that series, they need a lot of luck to come. I mean, every team needs a lot of luck.
Although they almost
team.
Won it in six games.
That's true.
Yeah.
Gerald Henderson, I always gravitated to McHale. I liked his low post
yeah,
moves.
I loved his game.
And then as I grew to be an adult and read about those teams, I liked McHale even more because Bird was like the serious assassin competitor.
Yeah.
And McHale was like the normal guy
yes.
who Bird would be like, I don't understand how you're not as crazy and maniacal as I am.
Yes.
And I was like, I kind of like the normal guy.
Yes. Yes. McHale was the guy everybody could relate to because he was, there was either him, or Cedric Maxwell used to have the Logan Airport PA make a PA announcement paging Dolph Schayes.
I don't think I've ever heard this story.
Yeah. And maybe McHale used to do it to make Maxwell laugh, or Maxwell used to do it to make McHale laugh. But either way, I thought that is something that Larry Bird would not do. He was too serious. Although a very funny guy from what I can tell.
People! Do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience, the only thing they should actually care about. But with millions of live event tickets and a price match guarantee, that's important. SeatGeek proves there's a better way. You can search for sports, live music, comedy, Broadway, more. I've even used them for Broadway plays. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. They built the fastest way to find tickets, so you can stop searching for the perfect seat and start enjoying it. Your days of scouring 20 websites on the secondary market are over. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web. It rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10 and displays them on an interactive seat map. Super easy to use. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots, maybe less good deals. Every purchase is fully guaranteed. That's important. You can shop for tickets with confidence. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the fastest and easiest way to find tickets. SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first purchase. Bam! All you need to do is use our promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast, for $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code LOW for $10 off your first purchase with SeatGeek. So you have this amazing special that's emotional and funny and personal, and it begins with a clip of a stand-up special in Boston from 2017, I think, which is a sort of rock
right.
bottom moment.
Yeah.
Where you're sort of telling the audience, you've reached a point where you're just going to say out loud what you're going through.
Yes.
And then you end the special. So you've clearly paid great artistic attention to all, how am I starting, how am I ending. You end, the credits are rolling as you're playing on a blacktop court
yes.
by yourself.
Yes.
And I immediately recognize it as the Sigma move. You're doing,
oh, yes,
you're practicing
yes.
Sigma, Jack Sigma inside
yeah.
pivots. And I turned to my wife and I said, he's doing the Sigma. And
yeah.
she was like, I don't know what
that's
that is.
That's so
and I'm
funny.
Like, it's a move that really only diehard footwork experts, like they're, like, I, I last year in one of my columns, I complimented Nikola Vucevic's footwork.
Oh yeah.
And I called him and we talked about
his footwork.
And then I sent him a text. I was like, hey, have you ever tried the Sigma move before? And Nikola Vucevic was like, I don't know what that is. What is
really?
That? And I sent him a clip of Hubie Brown teaching a group of players the Sigma move.
Was it during Red on Round Ball?
No, it was like a clinic. He's like wow. on stage at a clinic and Vuce was like, I got to try this in a game. Yes. I don't know if he actually did it. So how do you make the decision? That's the thought I want to leave viewers with. That's the image. That's what I want to leave people with.
I will tell you the entire story, and I wish I had. It's all subconscious and also a great director and editor. But the first day we did documentary footage, we weren't with HBO. Judd Apatow had just given us some money to shoot a day, and we were going to use that to try and sell it to HBO. So we had a day of shooting, and he said, I would like to interview you and your friend from when you were since we've been in sixth grade. We met on a basketball court. I said, we should meet there at the basketball court and we'll talk while we shoot baskets or near the court. I think it's a good backdrop. And he agreed. And so we shot that day. We didn't wind up using any of the interview with my friend. Later on that year, I wrote jokes specifically about my love of basketball and how it related to my loneliness and depression, and also about the bad basketball game that I had, which led me to my first contemplation of suicide.
We're going
to
talk about that.
Right. So we had that footage before I even wrote any jokes about basketball, and then the director showed me a cut where over the credits, instead of the initial idea was to put the end of the show where I do a meet and greet after the show, put that as the ending, which is natural and it made sense, but he really liked the look of the basketball and sort of the ease and the carefree nature of just shooting baskets by myself near my new home in New York. So that worked out great. When I first saw it, I was really blown away. I said, this is how we should end it. And then I have this friend who wrote an amazing song that the director happened to listen to and said, this is the perfect song to go over the basketball scene. So it was so much luck, good fortune, and maybe some subconscious, but The Sigma move was something that I learned early, and I noticed throughout my basketball, even just playing at the park, you could always get an open shot if you did the Sigma move.
People, because it's the opposite. It's an inside pivot, and yeah. No one expects an inside
nope.
pivot.
Nope. And there's so many moves off the Sigma move. An up fake and a drive, an up fake and a shot, or just a shot right away. You're gonna get that first shot because they don't even know what you just did. And I see a lot of guys, they don't even call it the Sigma move anymore. They just call it squaring up. But I see a lot of guys do it on the perimeter. But Sigma, I mean, wow, it was perfect.
Did you really shoot 94% from the free throw line as a senior in high school?
Probably 88%.
Okay.
Yeah, but 94% is funnier. It's more absurd.
It is funnier.
Yeah. Yeah. I just remember every year we would have this thing where we had like eight baskets in our gym in high school. It was a really big high school and everyone on the team would get a basket and you would shoot free throws. And if you missed, you were out. If you kept making them, you would win $5 from the coach. And I did it in 10th grade. I did it in 11th grade and I did it in 12th grade. I never missed. In fact, by my senior year, I said, why don't you guys see how many you can make in a row and then I'll just go out there and top it so we don't all have to stand
all
there.
Right.
And it was, and we did it much quicker because that was like the Christmas break treat from my coach who was the biggest asshole I've ever met in my life.
Really?
My high school basketball coach was the worst person I've ever been involved with.
Like an old school.
It wasn't even old school because usually old school guys are X and O's and they know their strategy and they know their calls and they're serious about basketball. This guy was just mean, gratuitously mean for the sake of being mean. He was Bobby Knight without the genius strategist, and Bobby Knight is as much of a monster he was. He was actually a very intelligent man, and this man was not, he was not an intellectual like Bob Knight. I mean, so Bob Knight is a monster, but at least those kids got better at basketball. I was worse by the time I left.
So
he ruined my
game.
That's
not in your special. He's not mentioned in your special.
No,
your
football
stuff is mentioned.
No.
So, but did that?
My football coach was a mensch and a gem and went out of his way to help me and changed my life. But my basketball coach was just the worst person.
Did it make it worse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I loved basketball and he took that away from me when I was in high school.
That's awful.
I dreaded practice. Yeah.
There's no worse feeling than dreading something that you just have to do for like several hours a day. Like the feeling of just, and then it's over and you're relieved and you're relieved. And then I used to feel that way about swim practice. Just because swim practice was just long and arduous.
Oh
and
my gosh.
It's just like physical torture. For
right.
Like 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've been up since 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
Yeah.
So your comedy is very writerly and not, it's just, and this is going to come across in two ways that I want to talk about. You already mentioned this. So you have two moments in your special where you make really, really funny jokes. I mean, most of the topics of your special are not funny, right? Depression is not funny,
right?
But there are two moments that are like especially not funny at all.
Uh-huh.
And you make jokes out of them. So the first one is the game you mentioned before. Where you play for your local synagogue against your local junior high team, and you feel the pressure of playing for the Jews, as you put it in the
playing
special.
For my people, yes.
And you're 0-for-18 or something like this, and you go home, and you look in the medicine cabinet, and you find a bottle of what you think are sleeping pills.
Yeah,
and you're like 12, 13 years old, whatever it is.
Yeah,
and you have the thought of if I take enough of these, I'll probably kill myself.
Yeah,
maybe I should do that.
Yeah.
That is not funny at all.
Like, no, it's so
I don't know
sad.
How you even look at that moment and think, well, I could write some jokes off that, but you do, and they're funny. And the joke is you look at the pills and you start making fun of how the pills look like. They're old, they're rusty, which is a wonderful word. And the bottle doesn't have a cap. It has a cork. So like you to take that moment and make it funny. Not only strikes me as difficult, but strikes me as something that a lot of people would not even conceive of to do. So like, how do you arrive at that place where you're like, I want to write jokes about that time?
Right. Well, when we were designing or developing the story of the Great Depression, because all my stand-up before this had been just a collection of jokes, and they were strong jokes, but there was not really a through line. And the director, Mike Bonfiglio, who did the 30 for 30 Doc and Daryl, and he directed You Don't Know Bo, about Bo Jackson.
Both very good
really,
ones.
Yeah, really good ones. All of the 30-30s. There wasn't one that I wasn't blown away by. Anyhow, he would ask me, he would just say, one thing was he gave me license. It doesn't have to be funny. He said, we'll figure out a way. Either we'll put it in the documentary portion and get to it that way. But if you can make it funny, that's ideal. He said, were there any times in your life when you were suicidal? And I said, well, I remember the first time, and it was over this basketball game and against the synagogue. And he said, try to write something about that. And then I would go try it out on my tour, and I would send him the audio, and he would listen to it, and he would give me just this great feedback. And you know from working with editors and people who are giving you feedback on your work, you can tell when they're being nice and when they're being honestly enthusiastic. And I could tell. I was like, oh, he really liked that. Otherwise, he would be honest enough in a gentle way to tell me, yeah, keep digging. And so I came up with that story, and he really liked it. And also, there was this license where he said, it doesn't have to be funny, but there's part of me that is most comfortable when the audience is laughing and not just looking at me. So that was the motivation for that one.
Did any part of you feel strange making a joke about a moment like that?
Yeah, there's that moment, because there were nights when the people were just not in the mood, when they didn't laugh at that. They thought it was heartbreaking and sad because it is. Yeah. And I had to learn to be comfortable with that and not immediately start melting down on stage because I didn't get a laugh for 30 seconds. But there was one moment where I thought this might be trivializing or offensive to people in the world of suicide, depression, or suicide attempts, where I talked about how I thought about suicide many times but didn't want to write a note, and it was because of a lifelong aversion to essays started with the SATs.
This was the second one that I was going to ask about.
And I went, Mike, the director, said, I think you should do that on the show. And I said, I'll do it the night of the show, but before we release it, I want to check with the National Foundation for Suicide Prevention to see if that's going to be... I know people get very, very sensitive about the use of the word trigger, but I said that might upset people, and it's not worth it. For one laugh to make people feel really terrible, it's not worth it to me. That's not the type of show that I wanted to put on. And we let them see it before we released it, and they said it was fine. So that was the okay I needed. But I was trepidatious about that because I felt that it could be construed as being rather blithe about something so serious.
So I'll tell you how I reacted to it. So the joke kind of comes out of nowhere too, with the show, which makes the impact even harder. You're just talking about essays, college essays, how you barely could get your act together to apply to college because you don't want to write essays. Then there's like a pause. You're like, in a lot of ways, I do feel like my aversion to essays repeatedly saved my life. And right then, before you explain it, the audience begins to realize where you're going with this.
Yeah.
You're going to talk about suicide notes and how you didn't want to write a suicide note. And I found it riotously funny.
Oh, that's good. Like my initial... People in the crowd loved it. I was really thankful for that.
My initial reaction was riotous laughter. And then I thought to myself, boy, that's not funny at all. Like that's a very dark
it's
thought.
Really
and
dark.
It takes some guts to be like, for exactly the reason you said, I can tread the line of making a joke out of this, but not trivializing what is at the heart of it. And that's very, very hard to do.
Yeah, I was really careful about that. And in the long run, I didn't think it would be worth it. If the group had said, no, that's a bit much, I would have taken it out. The whole thing when you write is that you have to be willing to get rid of the stuff, which shows confidence that you can come up with better stuff or different stuff. So I don't mind at this point. Earlier on in my career, I've been like, I can't write another joke.
Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven.
They say the best offense is a good defense. I think actually some people do say that. And that's especially true when it comes to the fuel you put in your car. It's time to help keep your engine running like new. Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline is engineered to defend against four main engine threats. Not one, not two, not three, but four. Gunk, wear, corrosion, and friction. The four evils. It's our most advanced fuel ever, protecting your engine like a solid stiff arm, a huge hit, or a last-second block like LeBron on Andre Iguodala. Like defensive lines on all premium fuels are the same. Now that is fuel for thought. And if you're a Fuel Rewards member, you save at least 5 cents per gallon on every fill-up with gold status. That can add up. If you're not a member, download the Fuel Rewards app or go to fuelrewards.com to join and never, ever, ever pay full price for gas again. In engines that continuously use Shell V-Power Nitro Plus Premium Gasoline.
So that's one of the things I'm always curious about, a comedy special.
Yeah.
So you obviously know the night that this is the night.
Yeah.
We're taping the special tonight.
Right.
So like, what happens if you get 10 minutes in and you're arriving at one of your home run jokes and you just like botch a syllable or trip over a word? Like, do you get a second chance to
great
do that?
Great question. Yes and yes. Okay. So you tape two shows and they mix it together. You just buy two shirts so that you're wearing the same outfit in both shows. And The thing that I regret is that my hair was so long, so I had to push it back so that it would look the same on both shows, because if your hair is long, it moves around too much. So I would have had a shorter haircut. So lesson learned. But before I went on, and I don't like to name drop, but I think this is helpful. Judd Apatow, who produced it, and I always feel resentful when people go on talk shows and talk about Judd or Lorne just by their first name.
Right.
Like, I know that that's what they call him, but I always feel left out. Like, oh, I'd like to be able to call Lorne Lorne. And I'm careful to always use the last name. So anyhow, Judd Apatow, before I taped, he was in my dressing room and he said, listen, treat the special like it's a film. If you flub a line, stop, tell the audience you're going to do it again. And he says, I promise you they won't mind and they might even find it entertaining and interesting that you're doing that. And he said also, and luckily this didn't happen, he said, if you're bombing, pretend that the joke did well enough that there's a little bit of a space between the time you finish the joke and the audience stops laughing. So leave a gap so that if we have to, we can add it. But luckily it was a hot audience. I've had audiences on specials where I would have liked to have left some space so they could have added laughs because it didn't sound great. But that was such great advice right before the show, and it freed me up so that I didn't have to get it exactly right the first time. And also I only used it once. There's this list of antidepressants that I took.
None of which are easy to pronounce.
Right. And some of them have to be in a certain order. So the first time I went through it, I got stuck and I said, let me take that again. And then I did it again and the audience was very proud of me. So they applaud at the end, but that wasn't natural, I don't think. But that was the only time I had to take something again.
You clearly pay a lot of attention to the precise wording of your jokes, which we're going to talk about. The word use is so strong. But then you also have to be able to ad lib. And, you have a moment, we talked about this over lunch a couple weeks ago, where you talk about that millennials get so much flack.
Yeah.
What did they get flack for? I can't remember.
Participation trophies.
Participation trophies. By the way, fantastic bit about the people who think that participation trophies are terrible, where you're you know, how are they gonna get used to failure, you know?
Yeah, how are they going to learn how to lose?
How are they going to learn how to lose? Yeah. How about life? How about living life? They're going to lose like all the time in life. That's
it's
what
all
life
losing.
Is. And then you have this moment where like, millennials take so much flack and all that guff that they take, you know, they take the flack and the guff. And I don't know which is worse, the flack or the guff. That's all ad-libbed, you
told
me.
Yeah.
What's the best ad-lib either in the show or of your career? The line that just like the moment that I don't like that.
Oh.
When you know like that was just. That was a fantastic little ad that I did off the top of my head. Cause that was a good, the flack and the guff.
Right.
I found very, very funny.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah. I would have to think about that. And I don't think we have time, but my best ad lib on stage. I mean, that line was a good ad lib the night of the show. And then there was something else that I ad libbed like the week of the show. Oh. Where I say that I'm not concerned about the impotence associated with my antidepressants. And I ad-libbed on one of the final shows of my tour. I said, oh, like I'm having so much sex in the fetal position.
That was an ad-lib?
Yeah.
That's a good joke.
Yeah, that was a strong ad-lib. So from the special, those were probably the two best ad-libs.
So here are some words that you used in the routine. You have a bit about, again, you're 7 years older than me, but boy, did this ring true. And it rang true like I had never even thought about it before, but it still rang true, which is very rare. How when we were kids, no one like talked to you about how much water you had to drink. And there was never water.
I know.
We didn't have any water filters. Nobody was constantly on top of you about being hydrated. And so you have a bit about drinking from the fountain after gym class.
Yes.
And the words that you use in the bit are so strong because you talk about how, bullies would try to smash your head into the water fountain.
Yeah.
But you don't just say that. You say cretins would try to smash your head into the iron spout.
Yes.
Cretins smash spout. I mean, those words are, spout is such a much better word than fountain.
Yeah.
Then you talk about how the teacher would count, like everyone's got to take their turn, so the teacher would count you out of your drinking. But you don't just say count you out of your drinking, you say limit your quench.
Ha!
Quench is the reason that joke is funny.
Yeah.
So of all of those words, like are there drafts of worse words, or do you arrive at those words pretty fast?
At this point, I arrive at them pretty fast. When I was a newer comic, I would have to write it out and think about it. And we're really getting into the writing weeds here.
But that's the process is what people are interested in.
Oh, that's good, because I could talk about that all day long. So spigot was another word, but it was too many syllables, and also sounds too written, right? Something that's not, oh, he spent too much time. You can tell spigot isn't something that we're using all the time. And then there's also, I've said steel spout, which is alliteration, but again, sounds too written and too rehearsed. An iron spout, for whatever reason, it flows better. But I know that one of my favorite quotes by Mark Twain, and I wonder if people of his generation used to say Mark, just Mark. They probably said Twain. I think back then you would just say somebody's last name, but he said, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug.
There you go.
The exact right word is so important. So spout, and then limit your quench. Yeah, that's just, I'm sure I ad-libbed that one night because it comes in a period. You kind of figure out what your rhythm is at some point and how often punchlines come in your act. And that was a moment where at some point I must have thought, oh, I need a laugh here. And I came up with that. And quench is just, it's, I have a friend named Rick Harris from New Jersey who was a comedian. And now I think he's an English professor, but he said that what people really love is not words that they don't know, but words they forgot they knew.
That's
and
a
hearing words that they hadn't heard in a long time. And I think there's great truth in that. Yeah.
One more in the weeds one.
Oh, you good.
In the participation trophy section.
Yes.
By the way, I wholeheartedly agree with you. The people who are like, man, they should get no participation trophies. Yeah. Like, I hated Little League Baseball. I'm glad I got a participation trophy. I hated
it. I deserved
it. I dreaded the ball being hit to me at every moment I was on the field. I liked the hitting. I like hitting. I didn't like fielding.
Yeah.
Anyway, you have this moment where you take apart the quote, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. You say, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. Boy, there are a lot of other things. Like, what about pause?
Yeah.
And in that moment, the audience is like, what is he going to say? What's the other thing? And you say, what do you say?
Collage.
So, and collage is funny, sounds funny.
Yeah.
Is like the opposite of sports and winning.
Yes.
What else is on the, like, what else was in that blank, if anything, before? Did it just go right to collage?
It went right to collage.
That's just, like, to me, in my head, there are like 90 things.
No.
Like, what about Frosties? What about miniature golf? What about video game? Just right to collage.
It has to be something that the audience was not going to think. Or had, and even to the point of, oh yeah, that's right, that exists. It has to be the same, like I said, what my friend said about a word that they had forgotten about. And I thought to myself, what is the thing about me that most people would be surprised to know? And one is that one of my hobbies is collage. I love to take the basketball cards that I grew up with that are not in great shape and overlap them in themes. Like, I have one really big one, which is all the players whose last name was Johnson in the 70s and 80s. And maybe into the 90s, because I remember the 2000s, because Amir Johnson was on it too. Yeah. So I just filled this thing with all the Johnsons, and it was awesome. And then I had one with all the great 70s and 80s hair. Like, there was great hair in the 70s and 80s in basketball, especially in the ABA.
So you and I are right in the perfect demographic of, we grew up with the NBA that looked a certain way.
Yep.
We have lived through this incredible transformation, which is going to end up being known as the Steph Curry / Mike D'Antoni transformation of the NBA.
Yes.
But
he's the Bill Walsh of the NBA, I think.
But we're still young enough where we're sort of still in our prime as sports fans. We're not just sort of casually paying attention to it and like, oh, that doesn't look like the thing that I know, blah, blah. So being in that demographic, what do you think of? Do you enjoy watching today's NBA as much as you did watching the one when you were a kid?
I enjoy the NBA today for the same reason I enjoyed the NBA back then. The or the things I enjoy about the NBA now are the same things that I loved the most about the NBA in the 80s. I don't mind that guys aren't taking as many in-between shots. What do they call them now?
Mid-range.
Mid-range. We used to call them outside shots.
It's true.
There were three-pointers and there were outside shots. So mid-range. I hate to use the vernacular when I'm not an expert, but the mid-range shot, the 18-footers, the Purvis shorts, the Alex Englishes, the guys who made their name off those mid-range, they played a beautiful game. Kiki Vandeweghe, it was still a beautiful game. And the fact that now I can't imagine why it took them so long to realize the incentive about taking three-pointers. Maybe they're just, part of it is they're better at shooting long shots now than maybe they were back then. But the thing is that I was watching the 84 championship series the other day on a treadmill, and the game seemed to exist in a much smaller portion of half court back then.
It's astonishing.
Yeah, and now it exists over the entire area of the half court. There's so much great spacing, and I just love it. My only question, and I wanted to, this was one of the things I wanted to ask you, is would there be a place for Mikhail and Parrish in today's game, or would they have to, I think they would have created and worked hard enough to make a way, but would their type of game been able to function in the modern or the current game?
So maybe 4 years ago at Grantland, I wrote a story that was about, it was like, this is a eulogy for the post-up game, but it's not really dying or it's not really dead. By the numbers, the number of post-ups just keeps dropping more and more and more every year. And particularly when you look at the number of possessions that are finished by somebody shooting from a post-up. But if you're really good at it, teams have been smart now for years about using it as a hub to draw help and then kick out.
Yes.
Like a little more difficult version of how the Rockets won the title around Olajuwon.
Yeah.
Like that's still going to happen. And I actually think it becomes more important in the playoffs where the best defenses, all the fancy that you can do, oh, pick and roll and kick over
right.
here,
yeah,
drive
yeah,
and
yeah.
kick. The best defenses are going to be better at taking that stuff away.
Yeah.
And that's why the playoffs becomes more of a, I mean, think of the Cleveland Golden State Finals. That whole finals was LeBron being like, okay, where's Steph Curry? How can I get myself matched up against the smallest guy on the floor? It becomes more of a mismatch game. So I think certainly there would be a place for, I mean, Mikhail's like shot 60% from the field. I mean, if you can do that, there will be a place for you. It's just, it's a more complicated place now. The passes are harder to make because defenses can help in all these like zone-ish ways that they couldn't when Mikhail was playing.
Right.
But I do think, like, the bad post-up players, you just are not allowed to do it anymore. Like, Dwight Howard's not allowed to do it anymore.
Right.
Bismack Biyombo is not allowed, like, one token jump hook every five games. But the best guys are still going to do it, and I think it becomes more important in the playoffs. I hope it becomes more important in the playoffs because I do worry a little bit about the game becoming homogeneous.
Right. No, that's a great point. Yeah.
I like watching good post-up players play. There's an art
Me too.
To it. There's an
Me
art
too.
To it.
Yes. And they still have great footwork. The great ones do. They still have excellent footwork. Not like Olajuwon or Mikhail, but Olajuwon has taught a lot of these younger guys.
Who do you like to watch who have you enjoyed watching this season? Maybe you've been so overwhelmed by all the fallout from this, especially you haven't had any time to watch.
No. I've watched every Celtics game.
Okay.
Okay. And then, so I'm blown away by Tatum, Jaylen. Gordon Hayward was all the way back until he hurt his hand, but I think he'll be fine. Kemba Walker I don't want to fall into bashing Kyrie, but this is much better chemistry for that team than Kyrie was, I think. And then I love some of the role players. Like when I was a kid, I loved a lot of the guys off the bench, but the Celtics have this guy named,
which Williams? I bet it's going to be a Williams.
Grant Williams?
Grant Williams.
Yeah.
Is the power forward of the two Williams.
And he's just, I expected nothing from him. And he just, every time he gets into the game. And then Brad Wanamaker, who's like one of the best stories in the NBA to have stuck with his dream till he's 29 to make the NBA. He played in Europe, which is significant, but it's not the NBA. And it's just such a great story. And he's excelling in Hayward's absence. And then I've watched Luka play several times because I've never seen anybody like him and Harden the same way. And then I've watched the Lakers.
There wasn't anyone dominating the ball in the same way as those two guys when we were growing up. Like, not even Jordan just worked from a different geography on the floor. Those two guys are doing, Luka and Harden are doing stuff that is, and Luka, like, I was watching that game against the Lakers a couple days ago. He just has he's 20. And he's like, every time he makes a step back through, he's thrown into the crowd and talking trash. I'm like, this guy just has so much swagger.
Yes. And his threes are not right behind the arc. No, they're really, they're Steph type. And yeah, so I'm blown away by him. The only thing I will say that I can't judge whether there was anybody like him or Harden growing up is that I never got to see Gervin more than one time a season. The Spurs were usually playing playoff games that weren't, even their playoff games weren't on national TV. So I didn't see Gervin that much. And what I saw of World Be Free on Cleveland, he wasn't the focus of the offense the way he was in San Diego.
It's funny. This is the second George Gervin conversation I've had today. I just came from another NBA themed entertainment event and we were talking, a few of us, about the late 70s, early 80s NBA. I don't know if anyone would buy that book, but there's a great book to be written about like the Lou Hudson Hawks and Gervin Spurs. Like just really good teams who never could quite get over the hump, but they were really good every year. They had characters
and
on
those
them.
Nuggets
it's
teams.
Kind of like post-ABA merger. Yeah. Like, I don't know if anyone would read that book, but there's a good book to be written about some of those. Like, Gervin is a great – Gervin, like, you look at his numbers like, oh, my God. This guy was unbelievable.
Yes.
And like, but people like you, where you're growing up, you barely get to see George Gervin play.
Hardly
like,
ever saw him. Maybe some highlights every once in a while and the magazines. It was all about the basketball magazines, the Sporting News, Sports Illustrated. You would get some coverage, but not enough.
Does the player movement bother you as a fan of an age where some people are bothered by the player movement? Like guys changing teams all the time and like, you know, trade demands and all these things that are becoming, hot button issues, let's say.
It's disappointing. It was ideal that we got to have Bird and McHale throughout their careers, but it was the players are making a huge concession by even signing for more than a 1 year contract. If they were going to the highest bidder, like in every other business on earth, they could get so much more money. The salary cap, I don't think it's fair. I just read the $40 million Slaves again and Howard Bryant's book. I don't know if you read that. So he wrote a great book about, it's basically where William Roden's book left off. And it was just incredible. So I think they're making a tremendous concession, even signing for 3 or 4 years. And yes, I wish LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh hadn't had that team together, because I think the Celtics could have won another one. But why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? They're that good. They deserve that. That doesn't bother me.
I don't want to get into the weeds of all that stuff. Yeah. But what I always come back to when people are like, oh, that's, players are ruining the league and taking over the league, I'm like, the players can get traded.
Yes.
Players requesting trades or exercising their freedom of movement power is not tipping the scales out of balance. It's just balancing the scales, because like, obviously a team is not going to trade LeBron. A team by their own volition is not going to trade these players. Yeah. But they can be traded. Yeah. And like, anyone outside the top five.
Yes.
You're at risk of being traded against your wishes all the time.
Yes. They've earned this. They have a very thin window to earn their money. I have no problem with it.
Looking for some other great NBA podcasts? Download and subscribe to my friend Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective, as well as the Woj Pod, wherever you get your podcasts. This week, Woj chats with Thunder GM Sam Presti, not exactly the most frequent interview subject, by the way, about the war chest of draft picks the Thunder accumulated this summer. A couple more comedy questions. So before this special, the bit that you were most famous for was obviously the quote-unquote documentary about the collection of experts who came up with the state abbreviations.
Yes.
And it's many versions of this are on YouTube.
Right.
People have already seen it probably. So two
questions. The Conan version is the most popular. I think it has like 30 million views or something like that.
It's amazing.
Ridiculous.
So what's the origin of that?
Well, The origin is I had this great book called The Arrow Book of States when I was in second grade, and I memorized all the abbreviations. And the tricky thing was always that a lot of the abbreviations weren't obvious.
Right.
Because so many states start with the same first two letters. So I really had to put in a long time to memorize all 50. And I don't know why I did. It's the same reason I memorized the colleges of the entire NBA in 1981. that to this day I know that Robert Parrish went to Centenary.
Yep.
And that Austin Carr played at Notre Dame, and nobody cares.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
They could Google it just like that, yeah. and nobody is impressed. So I memorized the abbreviating of the states, and then in 1993 I started comedy, and about 9 months in I said, I want to do that joke. It wasn't even a joke. I did all observation. I want to do the observation that most of the states start with the same first two letters, and I knew that there was going to be an argument between the men abbreviating the states.
So you go right to this fictional scenario. You
yes.
realize right away,
yes.
the thing itself is not funny enough. I have to create a scenario that
yes.
makes it funny.
I can't say, comedy had already gone past. Did you ever notice?
Right.
I had to go past. Did you ever notice all the states start with the same first two letters? And then the next step is to create a scene. And then, so that was 94 when I first tried it out in front of a high school like show that I was getting paid $25 or $30 for, and it went well, but it was only like two sentences long, and also I tried it a few more times and didn't get a good response, so I just shelved it. And then in around 2011 2006 I came up with the idea of a man whose job it was to abbreviate things, and added him to it, tried it out a couple of times, nothing.
A contractor.
Yes. Yes. And that was not an ad lib, but a fail. The first time I said his job title, I said contractor. And I meant to say contractor, but everybody laughed when I said contractor, and so I switched it. But anyhow, wow. It wasn't until I saw the documentary Helvetica.
I still haven't seen it. Helvetica is the subway font, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that documentary and it was amazing. And I thought, oh, you can make either film is cheap enough or documentaries are popular enough that you can do a documentary about just anything. And if it's compelling, people will watch it. And then, so one night while doing a joke about Helvetica, I said, and it was a complete lie, I said to the audience, have you seen this documentary about the men and the men who came up with the abbreviating of the states? And then I can't even explain, like any good writing, a lot of it, you can't even explain where the germ came from. It was, I mean, the Dottie character was just when we were in college, there were these guys who, one of the guys, his father was a plumber and he brought his father's tool set and started he tried to fix a leak and wound up flooding the entire hall with his father's tool set. And then he, as a joke, named the group of guys who had done this the Chief and Sons Plumbing Company. And there was this girl named Lisa who lived in our building. And he said, Lisa, you're the secretary, but you can't be Lisa because that's not a secretary name. You have to be Dottie. And for 4 years, she was Dottie. Well, to this day, she's Dottie.
She's always
everybody calls her Dottie.
Yeah.
She didn't actually do anything as the secretary. It was just this elaborate joke. Yeah.
Well, that's what I watched it again recently to prepare for this, and I had forgotten about how you take, I mean, Dottie I remembered, but the genius of the bit is that it takes all of these little side plots because you're building a fake documentary.
Yes.
It's got to have a lot to sustain an hour and a half. It's got to have
right.
a lot of plots.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you build in, my favorite one that I'd totally forgotten about was you build in the fact that they take a long break to have omelets from an omelet station.
Right.
Because in the 60s and 70s, the omelet station was like brand new. And it was a fad.
Yeah.
It was sweeping the nation. So
yes.
are there other are there other fads that were tried out? Like, how do you land on omelet station? I just don't understand. The process is just amazing to me.
Yeah, it's something that my comedian friend named Tom Ryan calls the parts store, where you have these fragments of jokes and ideas that never really made it into the act. So I knew that between Alabama and Alaska, I needed something to divert the attention from the fact that they had just come up with AL and they were going to do it again. And so I said that the guys were so excited that it was so easy. And that's the whole thing, is that they have to have all this hubris about how easy it is to abbreviate the states. And then it's funnier when they have trouble with it and they get angrier and angrier. And I had this joke about how omelet chefs were surly and resentful because they didn't want to just be making omelets, which anybody can make an omelet.
You had that joke like existing in
yes,
a separate
it
bucket.
Came from a vacation I took in which I could tell that the omelet chef hated me, and my girlfriend would go get an omelet every morning. She'd say, "You love omelets. Why won't you get an omelet?" And I said, "The omelet chef hates me." And I said, "And why wouldn't she? She didn't want to be the omelet chef, and I'm bossing her around." And I thought that was funny, and I would tell that as a joke, and nobody would ever laugh. And the whole thing was that in that joke, it doesn't have to be funny. It just has to make people forget that I had just abbreviated Alabama. And by the time we get to Alaska,
Wow. They've
had this whole story. So it was just something I lifted from the part store. And if it couldn't lose, it could have been anything.
I didn't know that it was a whole separate joke.
Oh yeah. It was a bad joke.
Last one, and then I'll let you go.
You're
a very busy man.
But this was awesome, man. There was just one basketball question that I had to ask you.
Go.
One was the Mikhail Parrish question, and then the other one is, I've noticed that the Celtics beat a lot of teams in the fourth quarter. Okay. And at first I was like, maybe they're better conditioned than all the other teams. But then I thought, no, conditioning a commodity in the NBA, that every team is conditioned so well and you're not gonna win that way? But then I see guys like our friend on the Nuggets, who doesn't seem to be in great shape.
I love Nikola. Maybe my favorite player to watch.
Oh, he's so fun to watch, but I think he could be in better shape. So is conditioning a commodity that everyone is conditioned the same, or are the Celtics making a difference with their conditioning?
Now, I don't know if the Celtics are, but I do think both on the individual level, like you just named one guy, I think Embiid is another guy whose conditioning is a subject of much discussion.
Right.
But my go-to example is, do you know a player named James Johnson?
Yeah.
Kind of a multi, so he's like fought MMA, like he's a legit real athlete.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Not that basketball players aren't real athletes. They
right.
Are,
yeah,
but
yeah.
He's like, you could put him into any sport and he would be good at it.
Right.
He went to the Heat, and the Heat have a famous conditioning program. Like they suspended James Johnson this year in training camp for failing to pass conditioning tests. And he was like in good shape.
Yeah.
He goes to the Heat, and then stories come out after his first season with the Heat. James Johnson has lost 30 pounds. And I'm like, I didn't think James Johnson had to lose like 2 pounds.
Right.
He lost 30. And I asked him about that. I was like, you lost 30 pounds? Like, yeah, there are some guys you look at like a couple months ago, I was like, I could lose 30 pounds. Like, I'm just a schmuck. Like, I could lose I looked at you, like, you're like a perfect specimen of an athlete. You need to lose 30 pounds. And he was like, I didn't know. And I feel like unbelievable. I feel
right.
I feel like a superhero. And so I do think there are degrees of it, and that it's a real thing. Why the Celtics are winning in fourth quarters, that's a good question. I think having a lot of good perimeter players who don't turn the ball over a lot probably helps. But there is an interesting sort of burbling discussion about the Celtics of, like, you have these teams at the top of the East now. Boston's better than people expected. Toronto is the best story in the whole league.
Yeah.
I think. Philly, Milwaukee, Miami's better than expected. Indiana is, hats off to the Pacers, they're playing unbelievable considering their injuries. And looking ahead to the playoffs, I think it's a fair and interesting question to ask about the Celtics is, are they a better regular season team than a playoff team? Do they have an extra level to get to?
Right.
Or are they maximizing what they are? Now, Hayward is hurt, obviously, but even when he was playing, are they maximizing what they are? And that's, like, I think a fancier version of saying, when they play Boston, when they play Milwaukee and Philadelphia, for sure, the other teams, you could maybe debate it, they won't have the best player in that playoff series, right?
Right.
So like the playoffs sometimes come down to like who's got the best guy.
Yeah.
And so that's so the Celtics are a good execution team. Like they make hay because they execute really well. They play hard all 48 minutes. And the value of those things diminishes in the playoffs because everyone is doing those things.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Well,
the last thing I wanted to ask you, if you will allow me.
Oh, of course.
Was you have a side bit. You have a, in the special, you have a, we get out of the special and you're talking to Robert Kelly, one of your comedian friends. And you have a great discussion about the idea that comics are, screwed up people, depressed people. Whatever their malady is, they're emotionally unstable. And that if they become emotionally stable, they won't be funny anymore. Now, I didn't expect that to be in the special. It is a sort of pervasive thought. And you guys come out like, I expected it to be sort of a, I didn't know where the discussion was going. I didn't expect you to come out and be like, not only is that not true, the opposite is true.
Yeah.
I'm funnier because I'm better. Is that still all these months later? Do you still feel that way?
Oh my gosh. Yes.
That was really interesting to me.
Yeah. Empirically, I can just point to the production and the, in creativity. So I got sick, I would say maybe the spring of 2015. And from that point until the fall of 2017, I wrote, I'll be generous and say I wrote 10 minutes of jokes, 5 minutes of which I did on Colbert, and the other jokes wound up in the special in a way too. So 10 minutes. And since I started to feel better that summer, so from fall of 2017 until now, I finished another 40 minutes of the Great Depression that made it in there, a half hour that we couldn't use and I don't want to do again on my tour, plus an hour and a half that I'm touring with now. So that's over 2.5 hours of material while I was healthy. The only thing different was that I wasn't spending most of my day in bed or worrying or angst ridden. So that, I mean, that's anecdotal. It's one person, but I know Robert in that interview said that he's written better since he's gotten healthy. And I know over the years, certain comedians and performers have gotten sober, which I think is a similar thing to mental illness and the recovery and the clear mindedness that you get when you're sober. And I think most of the people say they have done some of their best work. And there are writers over the years who would say, I could only write when I was drunk, but they were never out of it. So it's not really clear whether they ever had the opportunity and what their ages were and whether being drunk all the time made them less, took away their longevity.
Part of it is that being funny for you, or part of being whatever for me, is like actually producing stuff.
Yes.
Like if you can't, it doesn't matter. If you can't produce stuff, it doesn't matter.
Yes.
Like what the little trickles that are coming out might be funny, but if you can't produce it, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, you know.
But also when you're depressed, you're so critical of your work that a lot of it you wouldn't even release. You would say, this is and I'm not letting it go. So I think that's another part of it that I seldom say, oh, this is great, but I'm more objective in my opinion of my work now than when I was depressed. The same joke while I was depressed would get it's not good at all, it's useless. And when I'm feeling well, I say, no, this is pretty good. And it at least deserves a chance.
All right. Yeah. Gary Goldman, the special for people who haven't seen it is called The Great Depression. It's available on HBO. It is sensationally funny and also emotionally moving, which is a difficult thing to accomplish in the same thing. And I'm just thrilled that we got to do this. I'm thrilled that the special has had this ripple effect for your career and you're going to build on
it.
I'm
really grateful for that. And thank you so much for making this happen. I've been a big fan for a long time.
You made it happen. I did was ask.
But seriously, to talk basketball with Zach Lowe is a dream come true. So thank you.
Stop it. Watch the special. It's hilarious. You will not regret spending an hour and 20 minutes of your life doing it. Gary Goldman, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.